World War II was a turbulent time for Alaskans. The Aleutians were actually invaded, and airstrips even before the war were built in the middle of nowhere to ferry planes across to Russia. Then, within a few years, Russia was the enemy, and Alaska, again, a target. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The Cold War in Alaska, the subject today. Phone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Maybe you know where one of those weapons caches is. Let us know on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
So there it was, the headline in the newspaper. U.S. trained stay-behind agents in Alaska during Cold War years. Documents show. We have the documents. How can we not do a show in Alaska, a call-in show in Alaska, about this subject? I mean, it was, there could be people that actually remember this stuff, and I'm hoping that they will call. The telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. This is not speculation. This actually happened, and we have some people that know about it to some degree with us today. They're both from the Anchorage Museum. Katie Ringsmith is a history teacher and now the history curator at the Anchorage Museum, and historian for the Park Service for a while, too, I believe, right?
Yep, for about 12 years.
It's good to have you here, Katie. I'm glad you could come in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Aaron Leggett, Special Exhibits Curator of the Anchorage Museum. Aaron, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve.
Aaron was last heard from as the curator of that incredible environment about the Dena'ina country.
Yeah.
Quite a successful exhibition, I guess. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And now you guys are working together on the Alaska collection, I hear?
Yep, the new Alaska Gallery. Slated to open in 2017.
So that's a long time from now.
It doesn't seem like a long time to us.
Not when you're in the museum business.
Right. Just in time for the 150-year anniversary of the purchase of Alaska.
I see. And meanwhile, here we are in the Anchorage Centennial.
Yep.
And one of the events was a Cold War conference, which took place last week.
Right.
So the Cold War is hot.
It is hot.
So you might as well talk about it. And so when I was looking for sources, people to have as a panel on this show to talk about Alaska's secret Cold War history, I found that wasn't really a secret. But we do think, don't we, Katie, that people who might have been recruited as stay-behind agents were also told that this is top secret and never tell anybody.
Right. Yeah. As one Air Force historian put it, don't tell anyone about what you know or, you know, we're going to nail your butt to the wall, I think was pretty much the direct quote.
Wow. And so there could be people listening right now who remember this and say, you mean I'm allowed to talk about it now?
Maybe.
I don't know that they are, actually, to tell you the truth.
Right. Well, there were only, I think, about 89 at the peak of these stay-behind agents. And several of them had died because of old age. So I'd be very surprised if there were actually a living memory of people who experienced it directly. However, maybe they told family members or wrote it down in a diary or something, that it would be fun. But I think more than the people who actually remember these things, there's probably people who have come across some of these caches is what I am imagining would be the case.
Well, you yourself
stumbled across.
As a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, when I was working for the National Park Service, one of my jobs was to write a history of aviation in Wrangell's. And
so I assume this is related to Wrangell-St. Elias.
Wrangell-St. Elias, yes, National Park and Preserve.
So it's made into a national park in 1980.
80, right. Mm-hmm. So as part of the cultural resource management, our job is to assess the cultural resources. And so I was doing the history context around the aviation fields and the properties that were located there. And one of those sites, and a fascinating story, was Reeves Field at Nabesna. Now, Bob Reeve was before you know, glacier pilot, and he was made famous landing on glaciers in Wrangell St. Elias. Nabesna was one of them, and one of his buddies was Carl Whitman, owner of the Nabesna mine. And they'd fly in, need supplies, mining supplies, and fly out ore for Carl. And they had a small airstrip there along the Nabesna River. Now, when things started to get a little hot and Lend-Lease was passed, they needed to identify a site, and Northway was chosen as one of those, you know, incremental places to ship planes over to Russia to engage immediately in skies over Moscow
and
with
even
Germany.
To this day, I mean, that was a big enough airstrip that is actually the official port of entry for general aviation aircraft coming out of Canada.
So
even today,
no road, however, existed at Northway at the time. So
yeah, there's barely a road there now.
Yeah. Bob Reeve was freelancing for the government and was flying supplies to build the airstrip as well as personnel over to Northway. And so this became a big hub and fascinating story, but that's kind of where I thought the story ended until I came across an article about an engineer who said something to the effect that when these airstrips that weren't really used very much after the war, all of a sudden it was apparent that the Russians knew where they were, and if they were going to attack, then they would use those sites.
Yes.
And so it was a concern that these sites weren't being protected, and there was an engineer who came through, and he was evaluating these Lend-Lease sites, and he said something to the effect that if there was an invasion and the Russians didn't manage to get shot up, the watchmen would know what to do, which is strange. Now,
wait a second, watchmen?
The watchmen, which I was like, well, that's weird, because basically World War II ended gold mining in Alaska.
Yeah.
It was deemed, you know, an unnecessary industry to the war. And so basically, Nabesna shut down in 1947. It was done. And so the place was abandoned except for this watchman. And I was like, well, that's odd, and didn't really think much of it until I came across Kirk Stanley's book about Nabesna. And he refers to an article, and it's this article right here about a Nabesna faction. And they talk about two men who were basically recruited to oversee a resistance force that would protect this cache at Nabesna. And they had witnesses that remember army trucks bringing supplies in on the Nabesna Road in, they say, the late 1940s, early 1950s. And I was like, well, this is really strange. And they actually, and then in the 1980s, there were archaeologists there working for the BIA who uncovered a mine shaft. It was probably dug by Carl Whitman in the 20s, but it was never produced ore, so they didn't think much of it. But when the archaeologists were there in the 80s, they actually find this place. It had a door on it, padlocked, and a little sign that said, "Property of the U.S. Government, keep out." So
it's a government seal.
So I'm pretty sure I started, and that made me think, okay, well, this is worthy of some research, what's going on here. So I went to see John Clow, the longtime historian at the Air Force, and also the late Doug Beckstead, who recently passed away, and they gave me ample information about this project, the Alaska Project.
So it wasn't exactly secret. It just wasn't really
publicized.
Yeah, yeah. And Aaron Leggett, you went ahead and went into the website and got these public documents, or these documents now made public on one of those leak websites, right?
Well, it's not quite a leak website, but it, yeah, it's through the Freedom of Information Act, they're able to publish it.
And a lot of it's redacted. So
a lot
names
of
names are blacked out and so forth like that.
It looks to me like if they can't confirm anybody's over 100 years old, then it's redacted for the most part. So
wow.
So some of them...
They probably did use some rule of thumb like that.
Yeah.
We're talking bureaucrats here.
It's pretty... Because there's some of those that you can see, there's a few notes in them where they're talking about, well, no, this person was actually born in like 1912, so it's okay to release the name. So that's where most of the kind of the personal name information comes out of that in particular.
Gotcha. Well, we've already got some callers. Telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. We're particularly keen if somebody actually has a living memory or remembers Grandpa talking about this, or possibly, I've heard around Tuluksac, there may have been one in the Mud River area, one of these caches, and maybe they didn't clean them all out. I mean, if this was all so secret and everything, maybe they didn't clean them all out. But this actually did happen in 1950, I think, 50 or 51. J. Edgar Hoover, like, personally authorized it, and then a year later pulled out of it. But the intelligence office of the Air Force kept it going in some form or other. And what they were called, the stay-behind agents. Here it is. The Alaskan Project, Part 1. And this is actually from the Air Force Office of Special Investigations.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So these were published papers, articles by the Air Force. And so, you know, there is kind of a George Clooney sort of conspiracy Hollywood story in but, you know, it was actually a very pragmatic project, and it made sense. It started in 1950. The commander for here in Alaska, the Alaska Command, they wanted to be able to defend Alaska. You know, Governor Greening had just come back from Washington, and, you know, there was all this talk about moving Boeing to the Midwest because they were worried that the Russians could attack Boeing. And Greening's like, wait a minute, we need to defend Alaska because if the Russians are going to invade us, it would be through Alaska, the shortest route. And by the way, they know where all the airfields are. And so, within a year,
by the way, that's absolutely true.
We see the Alaska Project implemented. And it was there were two components to the Alaska Project. The first was the stay behind agents. And these agents were recruited, they were Alaskans, and they were brought to Washington, D.C. to be trained by the Office of Strategic Investigation. And then there was a second component, and that was the escape and evade caches. And they were separate. And no one who was involved in one program knew about the other.
Oh, my God. It's just incredible. And then, it's just taking my breath away.
And then within a year of going to D.C., they decided that it was attracting too much attention. They wanted to keep the project as top secret as possible. So the headquarters moved to Elmendorf, mm-hmm. Fort Ridge, to a little cabin, which they called the Abbey, just off base or a few miles away from the major activity.
Is that still standing?
I can't say for sure, but I do have pictures of it.
Wow. And this is happening even as we're talking here.
And it was a joint kind of run project, the Alaska Project. The Office of Strategic Affairs and the FBI both ran it. And as you point out, the FBI, once they recognize that this is really a military operation, they pull out.
I see.
Quickly.
So that's why J. Edgar Hoover pulled the plug on it.
Well, and there was a lot more. There wasn't much of an FBI presence, obviously, in post-World War II Anchorage at that point. So
good point.
Yeah.
1-800-478-8255, and Bob joins the program from Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Greetings. It's been a while, Steve. Yeah, well, I wasn't born until 59, but my aunt had a great memory of those times. Her and her husband came to Fairbanks in 1939, and her husband got the property together to build a cold weather testing base for aircraft, which became Ladd Field.
Right.
My father was the light operator on Ladd Field during the Lend-Lease. He operated along with some other people of the landing lights and the beacon lights for the field. But my aunt had a vivid memory of those days and talked about a lot of things. She worked for the U.S. Attorney's Office and how we were giving, we were loading those Russian, all those planes that were coming up here to Canada from lower 48, loading them up with all the stuff that off the shelves in Fairbanks. And the poor people in town didn't have nothing to eat. You know?
That's what she said?
She said she also witnessed them giving them, bags of money and bags of printing plates to print American money with. You know, I thought that was rather odd. I don't know what they were trying to do with that. But Yeah, those were very interesting times. She had a lot of good stories about that. She's passed away now, but by the time I was growing up, all those Nike sites were decommissioned. You know, my father had worked on those too, also, and. Oh, us kids, we used to use them for places to have keg parties, you know.
Yeah.
I remember at dinner table one time, Dad saying, we were talking about that, and I knew of three of them. He said, well, no, there were five, and because I built them. And he said that, well, it's been over 25 years now. I can talk about that stuff. That's been 25 years ago again now, but... Anyway, I heard stories also from some Navy friends of mine that on some of the outlying islands around Alaska, they would find Russian life rafts that, like, come from a submarine and tracks going inland, no tracks coming back out.
Yeah, those that track story, mostly St. Lawrence Island, but that track story is pretty well known.
Is it? Yeah. Well, I heard a lot about that.
Yep. Well, you're...
But I can't, I'm kind of on the spot here. I know you probably got other callers, but yeah, this is very interesting. I wish I could have made it up to Anchorage for the Cold War conference up there. You know, it was a whole different time, you know, especially growing up on the edge of Fort Wainwright. Like I say, I was born after that time, but my older brothers, I'm sure, in their rovings around the area there, probably found a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Well, have a good day, and thank you.
Yeah, Bob, and thanks for bringing us that that living memory. I love oral history. It's not like, you know, you can't really fact check it. There's too much to fact check. But just the stories that were told, that get remembered and get passed on, you know, that's a part of history.
Absolutely.
Well, you guys are building now this Alaska collection, reconfiguring it. How's it going to look, and what kind of role is this military part, this military thread of Alaska, what kind of part is that going to play in the story that you're going to tell here?
Well, I think, you know, right now is very early on to know exactly how the military is going to fit. But I think what's important is what the theme that we're really trying to convey, the major message, is that Alaska wasn't the end of the road, the last frontier, the bridge to nowhere. It was the bridge, going back to Beringia. When Seward wanted to purchase Alaska, the argument he made is that the Alaska served as stepping stones to Asia. It was our connection to the East. And Lend-Lease, the same thing. When they looked at that globe and they saw those Aleutians, they recognized that aviation technology was shrinking, that this ocean wasn't going to protect us forever. And they recognized that to help Russia defeat Germany in the skies over Moscow and Petersburg, they needed to send planes to Russia. And so again, that underscores that Alaska is at the center of a Pacific rim, and it connects the rest of the country to that Pacific world and is our connector to the circumpolar north. And that, to me, is really important, that the military story in Alaska isn't because we're some outpost. It is because we are the center, and we are strategically significant. In fact, historian Kathy Price, when she was writing about the history of Ladd Field, she writes that the Arctic would serve as a forward deployment zone and a warning area, a listening post, a first line of defense, and a potential resource storehouse. America's most northern territory became the western anchor for these Arctic and subarctic activities.
I think our view of history got messed up by the Mercator projection.
The map.
Yeah, because like this morning, this story ran this morning, I'm running it in the news, about how, well, when the Great Circle Route goes through the Aleutians, it doesn't just go through once, it has to go through twice.
Mm-hmm.
Why did I think of that before? Of course it does.
Right.
But, I mean, when you start looking at the globe,
right,
you know, that's how they came up with where they would put the airfields for the Lend-Lease planes. It was obvious and very clear
mm-hmm.
where where these airfields had to be pretty much if you flew.
Right.
And if you run boats, you've been running through the Aleutians for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And so it goes. So it's just like we're still looking. We still have that Mercator projection in our narrative. You can see it also even in the, they call it the westward expansion. So you think of the the colonies along the one coast, and then and then they pushed the Indians out, and they just went on across like a bunch of stripes.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not how it went at all. They actually... they had to get the French Empire that went to the northwest, and then there was a Spanish Empire that went even more to the northwest, and then they had the British to deal with.
Well, and if you go back to Beringia, most of our history is, you know, peopling the other way.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's really important that you have to take it out of that Western context, that last frontier context. Because if you only look at that, we're looking at the last 200 years.
Well, let's tune in on Mark. Joins the program from Bethel. Mark, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, good morning, Steve. How are you guys this morning?
Hi, we're having a great time. I mean, it's always fun to talk about this sort of thing.
I'll start to make a little bit of sense now. And let me preface all this with, I don't know, 20 years ago, I first heard the story of these caches out here on the YK Delta. The first one I heard about was supposedly up behind between Mountain Village and Marshall. And the person who told me about it was, oh, man, I'd love to find that because it's full of, you know, machine guns, Thompsons, and BARs, and 45s still wrapped in the Cosmoline.
Yeah, we're talking non-World War II stuff, right? We're talking more up-to-date materials.
Yeah. So I'm going to jump around here, but what all of a sudden makes sense, and I'm looking at these documents, and just so people know, you can find 701 pages of this stuff on www.governmentattic.com.
Right, and Aaron's got them all laid out in front of him here.
Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, people want to look it up. It's right there.
Yeah.
There's a list of communities where they suggested and regions that they have stay behind agents in. It includes the Kuskokwim River and Hooper Bay, and about 14 other communities. So the story of these caches is, you know, it seems kind of arcane. Some people have heard of them, some people haven't. Some people have heard, you know, detailed stories about people who have found them and gone into them. And some have walked out with, you know, some guns or some old radios. What makes a lot more sense than those caches being here for the stay-behind agents is that they were exactly like the lady from the Park Service, the museum said, they were evasion and escape caches. And what they were they were located in places for bomber pilots returning from Russia after a war. They would not land their B-52s. They would just parachute out because the planes were probably in pretty rough shape and they were running out of fuel. They would parachute into the vicinity of these caches and make their way to them and have what they needed to, you know, hopefully evade and escape for a while. So that part of the Cold War thing really starts to make sense now.
Oh, I see.
Those were E&E caches.
What do you think? What do you think, Katie?
Well, I think his story is corroborated by the articles that I've seen. The E&E caches that the caller mentions, he's absolutely right. According to the documents, that they were concentrated, they were built along the railroad and river drainages. The Kuskokwim and the Yukon are both identified. And they even talk about a few mining shafts and old cabins that they were used. And I have pictures of them building some of these caches. And I think what's also interesting is they employed a lot of the building methods that Alaska Natives used, especially in the wooded areas. So he's absolutely right. And the purpose for these caches was to assist air crews that had been, you know, that were crashed and they could survive in the most severe environment of the northern landscape.
Mark, you have more to add?
Yeah, well, just one more quick story. A few years ago, there was a report that the cache, you said Mud River, it's Fog River, up there between Tulip Sack.
Fog River.
Nyack. Fog River. That cache had been recently rediscovered. There's a story about a couple of guys who found it. They were out trapping. They both died a couple of years later in separate airplane crashes. But it was rediscovered. It may have been found by a Fish and Wildlife Service staffer, a pilot or somebody. I think that's what I heard, the recent one. So the story was, I was told by somebody with a lot of veracity that, an Air Force C-17 came into Bethel, which they do, came into Bethel with a bunch of EOD guys. They got flown out to the cache by actually a local fellow who's a Black Hawk pilot. Got flown out there, and they destroyed the cache. So I said, okay, well, let's check this out. So I called the EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal Detachment, down there at Fort Richardson, and I said, hey, I heard you guys come out and destroyed that cache out there. And the reply from the sergeant who answered the phone was, we know where it is, and we did not destroy it. Now, I would guess that they probably have been emptying some out, as they either come to the public's attention or they, there are maps. I mean, the military knows where these things are. But given the high value of the contents of them, and we're talking about, like I say, Browning automatic rifles, 1911 45s, Thompson submachine guns that are still wrapped up that are, pristine, that, are worth tens of thousands of dollars a piece, some of them. I expect they're cleaning those facilities out.
You expect.
But anyways, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
All right, Mark, thank you. Thank you for
Thanks,
that.
Steve.
But that, that conversation, that did happen.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, and he just said, we know where they are, we didn't destroy it.
He said, we know where it is, and we didn't destroy it. Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, Mark.
According to the articles that I've seen from the Air Force historians, they actually list what was in these caches.
Yeah.
They itemized 107 different items, such as food rations, medicine, weapons and ammunition, extra clothes, skis, snowshoes, sleeping bags, blankets, things like that. And the peak for the E&E and SBA programs was 1953, 1954. And by 1956, technology, unfortunately, the kind that allows ballistic missiles to fly right over Alaska, pretty much deemed this project too inexpensive, too arduous, and they closed it down. And by 1959, the caches were demilitarized. Some of them were less abandoned and allowed for the communities to take. So probably some of those stories, a lot of the stories, and people remember this.
Completely legit.
Yeah. They were allowed to come in and take some of this stuff. And by 1959, the caches were completely abandoned by the Air Force.
So the Cold War abandoned Alaska.
Well, at least they abandoned the caches.
Well, yeah, but I mean, seriously, with intercontinental ballistic missiles, the focus of the Cold War changed.
It did, but I don't think they abandoned Alaska. I think they stepped it up, especially after visiting that Nike site on
really?
Saturday. Yeah.
Was that a fascinating trip?
It was unbelievable. It was truly, and to go with the Nike veterans was truly impressive. And I live in Eagle River, and so my kids see it and say, oh, that's where they shoot off the missiles and the rocket ships, Mommy. And you do wonder. I mean, you never really, but it was really fascinating to see it from the perspective of the people who, and so the last base commander was there, the fellow who pushed the button that sent the very last missile up in the tests. It was very cool to see. And then just to be able to see that view of Anchorage and to really get the sense it wasn't what was behind us that was the interest of the military. It was what it was in front of us, looking out beyond Anchorage, beyond Fire Island, and, into the Pacific. That's what they were very much concerned about.
Yeah, well, even today, they didn't let our people photograph in there.
Yeah.
Even today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to turn to the historical context of all this and the Territorial Guard, and I'll do that as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
One 800 478 8255 is the telephone number. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And if you're calling from Anchorage, you can just use the local phone number at 550-8422. The program is Talk of Alaska. It's a statewide public radio call-in show. So we have people listening all over the state of Alaska, some of whom probably have memories of parts of Alaska's top secret Cold War history. And that's our subject. With us are two people who are assembling a public interpretation of the history of Alaska for the Anchorage Museum. Katie Ringsmith is history curator, and Aaron Leggett is special exhibits curator. And basically, they're redoing the Alaska exhibition, and it won't be open for a couple of years, but they're busy planning. And all of a sudden, out comes this story about stay-behind agents, you know, after the Second World War. We suddenly have the Cold War. And there was this plan, and it did happen, to recruit people to be able to be the resistance if the Russians invaded Alaska. This really happened. And they set up caches of weapons and radio, places where they could communicate from and have survival gear. And then separate from that was another program for pilots coming back if they were downed, that they could get at their survival gear and have a better chance of getting out. So these were called the Escape and Evade and Stay Behind Agents projects, also known as Washtub and so forth. And some of this has come out through Freedom of Information, and we're talking about it now. Aaron Leggett actually has the documents in front of him, and Katie Ringsmith has actually been to one of these caches up in the Wrangles at the Nembezna Mine. I mean, here's this mine, here's this airstrip that they used to get the Northway, kind of a staging area to get the Northway Lend-Lease base built, and then there's no mining there, and it becomes a place where one of these caches was set up. And as a historian for the National Park Service, she got to get a look at it. Well, did you break the seal? I mean, what do you do in a situation like that?
Well, I actually didn't physically see the site, so I was just looking at the documents that the BIA archaeologist had, and there wasn't anything in there. I mean, really, there wasn't.
It was
this,
empty.
Yeah, it was this. It's kind
it was
of
like Al Capone's
I know,
room.
Totally. But if you think about it, it makes perfect sense, right? Yeah. And I think what's important that the SBAs, these agents, were chosen for the skill set that allowed them to maneuver across this landscape.
Yeah.
They were trappers. They were guides. They were
right.
Bush pilots and mail carriers. And I think that's really important, not because it was romantic, but it made sense and it was practical, and they had a precedent from World War II.
And Dan and Palmer's called up to tell us that his dad was one of them.
Oh, very cool.
Dan, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for the show. It's been quite fascinating.
Yeah, well, did Dad talk about this?
Well, a little bit. As he got older and time moved on, they talked about it a lot more openly. But like you said earlier, it was kind of a top secret thing, and they weren't supposed to tell anybody about any of this.
Yeah.
But my mom and he worked together so he could learn Morse code and communicate as need be.
Oh, that's now that's authentic. That has the ring of authenticity right there.
Yeah, we still have a broadband radio that they supplied him with, so he could be in communication with whoever was out there. and a little miniature spy camera that he was supplied with to take pictures of anything that he could. He was a guide and a trapper, and was real experienced in the outdoors, and had also been a member of the Alaska Territorial Guard.
I think we want to. Katie wants to get in touch with you.
Oh, sure.
Because the museum would be kind of interested in some of that equipment. You know, it might be a nice home for it.
Oh, I'll bet it would, actually.
Yeah. Okay, well, cool. I will, if it's okay with you, I will pass your number on to her.
Yeah, sure. That'd be no problem. I'd enjoy talking to her more about this.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. That would be really cool.
Yeah. All right, Dan, we will do that. And you got more. So he was an experienced guide and trapper. And he had this stuff at home, or how did that work?
Yeah, it was always in our home. There were a couple of other people in the area, in the Palmer area, that were similarly contacted, I believe. So, like I say, they didn't talk about it very much until later. He passed away in 2000. He was 89 years old at the time. My parents moved to Alaska in 1938 and here to the valley in 1939, and he was active in building the bases at Fort Rich and Elmendorf during the war, and like I say, he was a member of the Territorial Guard as well, and so this all came up after the war, of course. I don't know if he was sent to Washington or, more likely,
Seattle, probably, I would think.
Yeah, more likely at the base in Anchorage is where he got his training.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they had him. They first went to Washington, the SBA agents, but then they decided to keep it close, and so they were right there at this place called the Abbey, and then they moved to another place called the Fortress. But it was located right there at Fort Rich, and that's where they sent him up. They had training for exactly as you say, that Morse code and photography, and their objective was really to hit and harass, I think, but to spy if the Russians come through, how to maneuver within now newly occupied enemy territory, and how to convey that information back to the base.
Yeah, that sounds exactly like what he talked about when he did talk about that. Actually, my mom talks more about it. She's still alive and has fairly good memories of these things, so she might even be able to supply more information than I can.
Dan, that's absolutely wonderful. I really want to thank you for calling. This is the kind of thing I was hoping we get on this show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for putting this show on. It's been a real pleasure to hear official confirmation of these family stories I've been hearing.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks. It's a privilege to be doing it. Thanks for that. Aaron, I want to turn back to this Territorial Guard, because I think it was your observation that it's amazing how little of what they actually could have learned from the Territorial Guard, they simply did not apply to the stay behind agents concept.
Yeah, in going through the documents, they list out for the selection of agents, and like we talked about before, they were very interested. So, for example, the second point is to lend mobility to this plan. Consideration should be given to carefully select bush pilots as potential agents and couriers. Likewise, consideration should be given to recruitment of persons who are businessmen, farmers, trappers, and fishermen. So it was about people that had been in the area. And looking at some of the agents, you know, some of them were really old-time, what we would call old-time Alaskans, but some of them had been there 10 years, you know, maybe less. But the third point for the selection of agents, it says, the selection of agents from the Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut groups in the territory should be avoided in view of their propensities to drink to excess and their fundamental indifference to constituted governments and political philosophies. It is noted their primary concern is with survival, and their allegiance would easily shift to any power in control. To me, that kind of flies in the face of what was demonstrated during the Territorial Guard, not to mention Alaska Natives who officially joined the military as well. Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
It is a thing of its times.
Definitely, yeah, that's for sure.
It's a thing that it's good for us to have a look at and say, well, you really need to look at that and then think about what where that came from, and and how it was just part of the way people were doing business back then and their assumptions.
Yeah, the other thing that, that I found in going through the documents was...
But it's outrageous. It's completely outrageous.
Right. Yes, yeah, that's for sure.
It's just like unbelievable. Oh, well, they just salute whatever flag showed up.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Because
when they were drinking.
Right, yeah, I know.
Man.
But what also was interesting is looking at the documents with the agents and the reports that they were providing back. There were also informants that were not, they weren't officially part of the program, but they the informants would report to the agents who then would submit the reports. And in looking at them, certainly along the northern coastal part of Alaska and other places, a lot of times it was the school teachers or doctors that would be interacting with the Alaska Natives. And reading through all of these, it's pretty pretty uninteresting. There was one example that I found where there was two brothers up around Deering who their father was Japanese and their mother was Alaska Native, and it seems that they got a little more attention than perhaps anybody else about potentially spy activities. There was one example where they talked about some Alaska Native from the village seeing one of these brothers out there with a pair of binoculars looking out, and they asked him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, it's none of your business." That was it. I mean, there wasn't really anything earth-shattering as far as, you know, espionage type of activities, but that's the only one that I could really find that had any hint of, you know, more deeper investigation. Again, a lot of these things are redacted, so you're kind of having to put bits and pieces together from it. But what also was interesting in talking about the escape and evasion training was that there was a short 3 or 4 page synopsis of an abridged Eskimo language phrase book that was developed. And the dictionary itself or phrase book isn't part of this, although in one of Katie's Katie's found a report that has something that I assume is very similar to what they would have had. But what's interesting is that they were, it clearly does demonstrate that they recognized there was a difference between Inupiat and Yupik, and that the languages and the connections between where they were spoken, but that if you could understand words from each of these, you would be able at some point to communicate with Native people. And it also looks like it would have been useful. I think they were thinking it would be useful if pilots were shot down in Siberia, that they would be able to communicate certain phrases and things to, say, the Chukchi or the Koryaks, some of the other indigenous groups there.
Nerkipiyumavunga. That's what they say Gaishpa means.
Right, yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. Wow, we're talking about Alaska's top secret Cold War history. Secret no more. Let's go to Bob, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Good morning, Steve.
Hi.
And hello to your guests. It's a fascinating topic.
It sure is.
The way I heard about Lend-Lease aircraft was in one of the interior villages where an airstrip was located. The elders told me that when they were asked to make land available for the airstrips, they said, "This is a patriotic thing, and we certainly will do that, provided that when it's not needed for military purposes, it should be returned to the village." And of course, under 25 years later, under the Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971, all of the airstrips went to the Division of Aviation of the state. And so what they said was basically, fast forward another 20 years or so to OTHB, the Over the Horizon Backscatter Project, when the military once again wanted the use of Native land. And the elders said, do what you need to do to make a business arrangement, but do not allow that land to leave a Native ownership. And the deal was a difficult one because it involved tax considerations and trying to make sure that the land, in fact, would not end up being bought by the Air Force. So what was worked out at the time was a perpetual easement that would revert to the village on abandonment. And shortly thereafter, Congress decided the Soviet threat was not as big as they thought it was, and they did abandon the project, at least the receive site. And the Air Force said, could we have our money back, please? And that was an element of humor.
Yeah.
The funds went to establish a permanent fund for that village. And seems like in the long run, that's poetic justice.
Wow. Bob, thanks for that. Great insight.
Certainly. Have either of your guests heard any of elements of that tale?
I haven't heard anything specific. I know that Steve Haycox wrote an article, and it's a little bit related. It occurred during World War II when Native villages were removed, particularly for building parts of the Alcan Highway and some of the airstrips. In just the research that I was doing for aviation, I came across that article, and I know that the village at around Copper Center had been removed and people relocated and not compensated for their loss. And again, as Steve mentions, it was a context of the time. Racism was rampant and Alaska Native people were not treated fairly. And that's just the reality. And I think that the military would be the first to recognize that today. And today we have a military that is the most diverse and educated in the country, and so they are making clear strides to change that.
I think
kind
it's commendable that official agencies are recognizing that element of history. Thank you.
Yeah, one thing I did want to mention is in going through looking at all the agents that were listed, for mostly it was for to do background checks. There were about three or four of them that came up that had a white father and a Native mother that were considered. So they list, you know, half Indian, half white. One was three quarters white and a quarter Eskimo. So it appears that it wasn't perhaps, I mean, it was racist. There's no doubt about it. But it wasn't that if you had any Native blood that you would be automatically excluded from the program. But again, they represent a small fraction. And I think it was probably had more to do with the locations that they were at, like at Deering or Sleep Mute or Golovin or Rampart, you know, places like that. But that and all these individuals, you know, they list their like one was like a tugboat captain and things like that. So they were considered prominent members of the community.
And it made sense.
Right, and it made sense, yeah, obviously.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking with Aaron Leggett and Katie Ringsmith, both of the Anchorage Museum. We're delving into Alaska's Cold War history. I think it needs to be said that this, because it was a military operation, it's kind of comes out in bits and pieces. And it's maybe to the military's credit that they even wrote up this history at all, what little they did, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Well, it was called Wash Tub. It was called the Stay Behind Agent Program. There was the Escape and Evade Program. And they really did happen in the early 1950s, pretty much contemporaneous with the Korean War. The Korean War finished up in 1953, and, you know, there was active combat there, and there was real worry about the communist threat. But I'm wondering, Katie Ringsmith, if just how realistic it really was to think about the Russians landing special forces troops to come in and knock out critical military facilities in Alaska.
Well, that's a good question. And I think if you look at the context of Cold War the atmosphere of conspiracy, then they probably did think it was very realistic. I mean, when you think of McCarthyism and all of the House of Un-American hearings that were taking place in the late 1940s, trying to identify these commies, spies, right? We're not talking about a guy who walks around with a uniform that says, "I am the enemy," plastered on his shirt, right? We don't know who they are.
The enemy and among us.
Exactly. They were going to infiltrate us from the inside out. And, you know, pop cultural historians and people who study, you know, this time period really talk about this was a war, not so much against communist Russia, but against America's demons itself. And there was a lot of goofy stuff that was happening. And this very much is an extension of that kind. So, you know, it wasn't just that they were excluding Alaska Natives. There were a lot of, you know, strange things that were being perpetuated because of the Cold War mentality.
I'll have to say, as somebody growing up in the 1950s, so born in 1943, I was, you know, right in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And I can remember listening to Gangbusters on the radio, which was on a little later than my parents wanted me to stay up, but I usually managed to. And at the end of Gangbusters, they would give you the most wanted. They would give you descriptions of communist spies that were at large now. And I would think about whether I had seen this person, my little town in Pennsylvania.
I would
hide behind trees when I went out at night. I mean,
did
it
you
was
read
so
the
real.
The Mickey Spillane, Mike Hammer?
Pulp oh, I would
fiction
never been allowed to touch
no,
something
but,
like that.
But yeah, I had a professor in grad school who kind of pointed those novels as the guy who invented the secret commie spy. It came really out of a Pulp Fiction writer's head rather than, you know, McCarthy's, I have, 102 different names of communists working for the State Department at a, you know, a ladies' tea party. I mean, just to accentuate the hysterical nature.
It did have to get into the popular culture in various ways. And I think that with Spillane, my remembrance of it is that he was just of a, he was a of a different social element. He was not in the bourgeoisie, you know. He was definitely Mr. Working Class, slug it out kind of guy, you know, shot in the beer kind of guy.
Right.
So,
it was and Stalin at the time wasn't helping, right? He was positioning troops in Siberia, and you know, it was a very scary time.
It was.
And Edward R. Murrow, in fact, recognized that, right? He said, "No time in history has a nation won a war, been victorious, and been so anxious and so scared."
Well, Joe joins the program from St. George. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Joe. It's great to talk to the Pribilofs.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Good to hear the show here.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear from you.
Yeah, I've been listening to you like you every Tuesday, so I was kind of wondering, you know, since you were talking about, you know, back in like World War II, like, and stuff like that, I was kind of wondering if your host knows about what went on with the Aleutians when us Aleuts get evacuated from like 1941-42. On the Delaroff down to Funter Bay. I was kind of wondering if she read about that or was any more understanding about it.
Oh, I'm sure. That's a part of history that kind of got forgotten for a while, but I think it's quite well remembered these days, wouldn't you say?
Well,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly going to be, it's one of, I think, our most painful period in Alaska's more contemporary history, and it's one story that should not be forgotten. Absolutely. Alaska Native people living in the Aleutians were evacuated very little time, and they were sent to sites to remain out of the war zone, and they weren't allowed to go back. And it is an extremely painful time in this, in our state's history.
Yeah, you know, like, you know, for me, my grandfather, he's buried down at Funter Bay. So I had a lucky chance on heading to Punta Bay to go see his gravesite. And, you know, and I see the way they lived way back then.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it was rough.
Abandoned canneries and wet.
Yeah, it's all, you know, broken down canneries, but they had to, you know, rebuild the roof or try to make it suitable to live in, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and some people didn't make it through.
Yeah.
Nope. No.
Yeah, Joe.
There are quite a few of them.
Yeah, Joe, thank you for that and for sharing that with us and telling us that, you know, it was important enough to you. You wanted to get down and see that grave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It means a lot, Joe. Thanks.
Okay, yeah. Thanks for inviting me on the show here.
Yeah. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Ben Joins Program from Kiana. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ben.
Thanks for inviting me. You know, I'm a Cold War veteran. Haven't been to any hot wars, but, you know, a lot of things happened back then during the Cold War. In fact, not many people know that the Bureau of Indian Affairs was created by the military, and that our people are under military protection, if you will. So that's just a piece of information I'd like to give out.
All right. Anything more, Ben?
Yeah, well, it's a type of genocide.
Yeah.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs, put out a memo quite a few years ago that said I don't have the document with me now. I lost it, but I can try and find it again. The Bureau of Indian Affairs memo said that in order to take the resources from the indigenous peoples, we have to set a blood quantum of one quarter or less. That way, we can send in our missionaries, our educators, and there you go.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know about that specific memo, but I mean, you know, termination was the official policy of the U.S. government for quite a while. It was the idea,
right.
we got to make Americans out of these people. Because their culture is going to die,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So in essence, our people need to wake up. Wake up.
I believe we're out of time. Thank you very much for that. A great way to end the show, Katie. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for having
Steve.
Me.
Yeah, that's great, and I look forward to the progress of the exhibition as time goes on. Maybe we can have you back.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk of Alaska. Probably next week we need to get back to some of the political issues coming up in the election and some of the candidates. We're having trouble getting some of them to confirm. Imagine that. Thanks so much, Dave Waldron and Josh Edge. And I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.